Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the HSBC conference call with Coca-Cola. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. Also, today's conference will last approximately 60 minutes. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker for today, Mr. Carlos Laboy. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Amitris. Hi, this is Carlos Laboy. Everyone at HSBC, we're thrilled today to have Tim Leveridge, Director of Investor Relations of the Coca-Cola Company, Galia Freiman Molinas, President of the Mexico Business Unit, and Alfredo Rivera, the Group President of the Latin America Division, with us. The idea today is to focus in on some next frontier issues and to try and look well beyond this crisis here, perhaps reference the crisis only in terms of how it helps us leap forward in some of the initiatives that were already underway. Galia, thank you for doing this. I think that if you don't mind, we'd love to start with you and with your background.
Sure. It's a pleasure.
It's a good place to start, really, is with the path that took you to this current position. If you could give us some background on that. You were a senior VP of Global Strategy and Insights. And I was curious when I saw that because it's a really important function in the context of the Coca-Cola Company. And I'm curious how you think about this background for your current job. I'm asking because everyone always talks about being a consumer-centric company, but there's a real linkage of strategy to insights to culture in a consumer-centric organization. How do you think about that linkage of those three things, and how do you bring that to your current role?
Yeah. Hi, Carlos, again. Maybe a good way to start could be starting with an example. One of the focus areas that I had when I was working at the corporate in the strategy function was the development of portfolio strategy and resource allocation, as we defined it as the first discipline for growth. This was built on three pillars, and these pillars were, number one, fewer, bigger, but scalable bets. Number two, winning both in premium and affordable segments due to the bifurcation that we were seeing, particularly in the middle-income classes. And number three, optimal system resourcing, and that goes into Leader Challenger Explorer framework, identifying the corridors of refuel rates, cutting the long tail, et cetera. When we talk about the fewer and bigger scalable bets, we actually talk about putting our bets against brands that have an edge. So that's how you see, how this integrates with the consumer insight, if you like. So last year, when I arrived here, this is what we implemented in Mexico too. The portfolio strategy and this resource allocation framework actually led us as a system to a much higher level of focus, where we now have much less but bigger bets in our hands, and similar thing with the investment line items. So that's also there's a cultural element to that as well. Because this approach also broke the typical inertia you would see towards incrementality in terms of budgeting, and actually helped us to install a zero-based planning approach, again, for the system. So we did build capability on that. We were together with the bottling partners, and we built capability. We developed a culture. We developed a system approach to that. So a few examples could be on the brand side, we accelerated premium age-based innovation, with Coca-Cola Cafe, with Topo Chico. We really focused on bets for brands that have an edge, and that would include, other than Coca-Cola, obviously, that would include like Powerade, Mundet. We cut what we call the zombies, 34% of zombies as of today, between last year and the first quarter of this year, have been cut from the Stills portfolio. And yeah, I can give a few other examples, but that's so when we faced, obviously, COVID, this framework was also very helpful because we streamlined our priorities towards the 40 SKUs, which accounts now for 75% of our system's variable contribution. So it's a story of focus, but in a very people-centric way, I would say.
Oh, that's super insightful. As you focused on those 40 SKUs that are 70%, can you give us a bit of a sense of whether they're spread, how they're spread in terms of returns, right? Those 40 are your highest return for the bottler, or do you have some experimental SKUs in there as well that you're preserving and growing because they show a lot of promise?
Yeah, for COVID now, first of all, the whole approach was looking at system economics. So it wasn't like, you know, favoring one part or the other. It was really like, you know, looking at the system economics. Therefore, the bottler numbers were critical. If I can, so those 40 SKUs obviously look at the highest returns for the system. Therefore, it includes both like SKUs from the affordability segment where we're making quite a bit of money from a percentage perspective in terms of like, you know, maximizing margins, but also from a dollar standpoint. A good example could be really Powerade. And on the other hand, we're also having a special package which is on in a different spectrum. So it includes all of them, but net-net, we really focus on the 75% of the variable contribution.
Okay. Galia, so you're a year into your new job in Mexico and COVID-19 hits. What are some of the early insights that you're getting on how this crisis is going to change the Mexican consumer? And as you think of the retail trade as well, not just the consumer, how do you think it's affecting the mom-and-pop stores and the consumer behavior in those stores?
Yeah, we're seeing very interesting insights, actually, to your point. It seems that it is changing consumers' shopping and consumption habits in a way that this is not going to go back. So it's changing it for good. From a like consumer pattern standpoint, what we see is that, first of all, Mexico really resembles those that we see in other markets, and that would, like, you know, we see sparkling pretty resilient, we see water going up, dairy going up, etc. So categorically, we're seeing, like, you know, very similar situation. What's special about Mexico, though, and that might be true also for Latin America, is that economic impact in consumers is felt much earlier than the health effect. So if you think about it, one-third of our population here lives on a daily basis. So therefore, the crisis has really amplified what we call the reality of the two Mexicos, the reality between the haves and have-nots. Let me give an example because I think this is important. Higher socioeconomic levels are working and studying from home. They're trying to make sure that their children are online, have online education and all that stuff. While that happens, they're very interested in home entertainment, etc. While that happens, the lower socioeconomic group is really struggling to survive. They cannot afford to stay home. And it, so therefore, like, you know, the priorities for these two groups are completely different. And that's why keeping consumers right at the heart of our choices, we have to make sure that we address the reality at both ends. Couple of other things, again, not really exactly similar to what's happening in other parts of the world, is that traditional trade, like we see overall across Mexico, about 5% of the stores are closed. Clearly, on-premise has collapsed, but not to the level that we're seeing in other parts. 35% has, you know, closed down. We also see that traditional channel is incredibly resilient. Consumers obviously adjust their spending, their stoppings on non-essentials, they're prioritizing health, cleanliness, you know, the hygiene, they're after promotions and saving. Affordability is key in this, but so is value creation, very critical. So from a portfolio standpoint, that really requires that we're focused on those ends. And then we also see there are, we have a, like, you know, sizable direct to home business, and that is going up significantly. And so is our digital business, really more than doubling itself. That's what we're seeing as well. We're in a very privileged position in Mexico because of our expansive portfolio. So the portfolio has depth, and the portfolio has like refillables, non-refillables, premium brands, less premium brands. So it's really a very wide portfolio, which is positioning us in a very in a very good way, in a very strong way. Let me put it that way. Yeah, so it is, it's just like, you know, from an insight standpoint, we're also really challenging our mental models, some of the mental models, like single service only for on the go. We see that in-home is an occasion there, like multi-service only for meals. We see that there are other occasions, et cetera. So this is really a time for opportunity for us. That's what we're seeing. But this is why we're very focused on the on understanding the consumer reality.
You're weathering the storm in a very nice port. Mexico is a great place to be for these crises, because it seems to transform itself out of every one of them very nicely.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
I want to go to the issue of affordability that you mentioned earlier. We hear a lot about affordability in Mexico and how they use refillable bottles. But brand Coca-Cola is also the most premium beverage brand in the country, non-alcoholic beverage brand in the country. How do you optimally develop and capture the value of the brand at both ends of the spectrum even better than you're doing right now? And then your bottlers maybe have traditionally done. How does this crisis open your thinking on that?
To that question, Carlos, I need to talk a little bit about the capabilities that we as a system have developed. And again, it's a system capability. It is not necessarily only on the Coca-Cola side or only on the bottling side, but it's really, truly a system capability. And here I can talk about... maybe I should, like, you know, refer to those capabilities. One portion is really like software and market segmentation, revenue growth management are good examples to that. And then the other part is more the hardware, where we have one of the biggest parts of coolers and racks. We have a part of refillable bottles, infrastructure. We have the direct-to-consumer routes, which are reaching 1 million households, et cetera. So all this together, we are able to segment the market in such a nice way that we can strike an optimum balance between, even within Coca-Cola, between, let's say, refillables and one-way packages, where we can maximize margins, both, again, from a percent, but also from a dollar standpoint. maybe a good example to that could be like, you know, our PET 600, which is a major package for us, and the returnable 500 ml, another hero of our package portfolio. The PET 600 is for convenience, and then our GB 500, the returnable glass bottle 500, is for affordability. And their returns are different, but they all add to the premiumness and to affordability. So this is how we're managing it within within brand Coca-Cola. The fact that out of our sparkling business, the fact that obviously 40% of our packaging portfolio is in returnables positions us very strongly, particularly in that crisis. And also, like, you know, to address, to be able to address both premium and affordability.
Just to stay with refillables for a minute, in Mexico, how do you view the future of this package in Mexico? Because the ecological merit of the package seems to be important and growing. And so is there an opportunity to market more aggressively the ecological merits of it, and maybe to not only make it an affordable package, but also maybe a premium package for consumers at the higher income levels who are willing to pay a premium for the ecological badge and merit of it?
Yeah, you're making a very good point, actually. The reality is that different socioeconomic groups consume returnables for different reasons. And if I could give an example, more obviously, like in lower socioeconomic groups are much more interested in the affordability of it, whereas the higher ones are more interested in the whole ecology point that that you've made, the world without waste, etc. To that point, we are actually very aggressive with the returnable packages, both in the single serves and also in the multi-serves. Let me give an example on that one. We launched Universal Bottle last year, in the second half of the last year. Universal Bottle is basically one single bottle for all flavored sparkling brands, and you can also add Coca-Cola to that. And we have also added, by the way, even juices, fruit juices to that. The consumer insight behind that was both on delivering the convenience, but very importantly also with one bottle allowing for variety. Just think about it, that you would go to a mom and pop store, and you would have, like, you would give the shop owner your bottle. And in exchange, you can buy any sort of any of these products, whichever, like, you know, works for you. So that really, we understood that for the consumer, that was really a very critical point. So therefore, it was both on convenience, allowing variety, and also for the lower SEL group, it was really about the affordability of it. As you go to the higher upper end of the pyramid, however, we realized that it also had another tangible demonstration, which was about the environmentally friendliness. So, and that's why our refillable packages are very strong in our direct-to-consumer business, which goes usually like into higher level. So, in a nutshell, a quick answer to your question is yes.
On sugar, another ESG issue, you've taken a lot of sugar out of your portfolio in Mexico in the last couple of years. Can you speak to that and to also how you're preparing, well, how this has prepared you and how you're preparing for the October changes, or I don't know, they'll happen in October, the nutritional labeling changes that were expected for year end?
Yeah, the nutritional labeling changes are October 1st, as you said. There are a couple of things that, like, you know, that I can highlight on that one. Number one, we are the first priority, obviously, is to comply with the law. This is not the first time that a labeling regulation is changing in a country, so we're very focused, obviously, that that we're in time until October 1st in terms of the entire portfolio. We're very focused on clearly understanding the consumers, what they want, the type of products they want within that, like, you know, within that context. So therefore, like, you know, this also is considered, like, you know, from an innovation standpoint. Again, the fact that we have a broad portfolio, which also includes, like, you know, other categories that are exempted from this norm, is an important one. I mean, the portfolio is really, like, you know, has products that are impacted, but it also has products that are not impacted. So therefore, like, you know, we are going to be focusing very much moving forward as well, continuing with the non-cal offering. We're going to continue with the sugar reduction even further. And other unsweetened options in the portfolio are also going to be important, like Topo Chico could be a good example to that. We will further boost the single-serve packages, so this is another one that is strategically important, particularly as we get prepared, like, you know, for the new labeling law. And at the same time, very importantly, I have to, like, underline that we will continue strengthening Coca-Cola and other sparkling brands through brand building, through frequency and affordability programs. We believe that this is a critical, critical piece of the strategy.
Thank you. One last question before we move on to Alfredo. You're on the board of Isocheck. You've now had the benefit of seeing Mexico up close as a foreigner. What might be some of the biggest market development opportunities that you see for Isocheck after 16 months in Mexico, and also the reverse? What impressions might you have of Mexico that maybe we Latin Americans underappreciate or get too pessimistic on in a crisis and maybe miss?
Yeah, look, I really would not want to talk about Isocheck just because I'm a board member, like, you know, a director on the board there. It wouldn't, like, you know, position me in the right way to talk about them. However, as I, like, you know, on your second question, there are lots to learn, obviously, from both ends. Like, you know, one thing for sure that I believe might have been underappreciated, at least at my end, I'm seeing it, is that Latin America, and particularly like Mexico, has been a fairly stable, has had a stable economy, has had a fairly stable, like, you know, macro environment, as you compare to some of the dynamics, like, you know, that that we have in Central Asia, in Pakistan, in Turkey. So therefore, like, you know, coming in, and this is like, you know, I've been here almost a year and a half, I can't tell you how much I appreciated that part. I think we're learning now with COVID to go into something else. And I think fortunately or unfortunately, I had built some muscles on that one, not because I wanted to, but because I had to. So.
Well, Galia, thank you so much for your insights and best wishes in your Mexico efforts.
Thank you.
Alfredo Butlers.
Hola, Carlos.
How are you?
Good.
Alfredo Butlers are never shy to complain about the Coca-Cola company. And that's part of what we hear them do as analysts. So when Latin American bottlers start honestly raving about how active the company is being this last month or two in terms of driving dialogue and sharing insights and best practices from across the world, it sounds fresh and it sounds new and it's very different from what we've heard in previous crises, where everyone seemed to be more of a silo in terms of how they went about dealing with their with the issues. Can you share with us your thoughts on all this activity, what it really means in terms of the cultural transformation that the company's is driving, and how it's trying to drive relationships differently with the bottlers as it gets more mature.
Thank you, Carlos, and hello to everyone. It's a very good question. But before I jump into that, I would like to recognize, by the way, that our bottlers are doing a great job in Latin America during this crisis, in particular, considering that all of us as a system are focused on the safety and well-being of our more than 200,000 associates. And our bottlers are doing a great job with our consumers, customers, and communities. And I want to recognize this. I know you've spoken to Andina earlier, and you'll have Arca and Coca-Cola FEMSA tomorrow, but I think it's important to see how the strength of our system is reflected in their efforts, not only from a commercial point of view of maintaining the business going, but the fact is that they are providing important services to our customers, our consumers, and the communities. And we're working together with them, but obviously they have a lot of frontline associates that are doing a great job. So, and I wanted to take this opportunity to point that out. With regards to your comment, with when James became CEO and then CEO, he was always very forthright in how he wanted to build a stronger relationship with our bottling system. With the appointment of Brian as a COO, I think that has been, I think we've doubled down on this idea that we have to have clear and transparent communications on how we work. The crisis provides, and therefore there were some routines created even before the crisis that were meant to take us on this path. Brian created a global bottler a meeting where, with the idea of creating a network of bottler communication, not only between the company and bottlers, but between bottlers themselves. How can we encourage that? We do it at the Latin America level. We have a CEO council of our three largest bottlers and myself, where we meet quarterly. And that has allowed us to share more openly, and to discuss, and even go after certain initiatives together. In the specific case of COVID and the crisis, we did decide very early on that we would rather over-communicate than assume that people had the information they needed. And what we're trying to do is ensuring that we are constantly in communication, sharing learnings. The fact is that the crisis, the virus came to Latin America after other parts of the world. So we were able to learn from our bottling partners and our company associates in other parts of the world, and we were able to adapt our plans based on their learning. Just to give you an idea or an example, very early on, I'm on the board of Hellenic, and I was in one of our calls, and they showed some pictures and some protocols of what they were doing in Italy. Italy, which was had a tremendous impact from the virus, Hellenic did a great job to continue operating without any major issues. Their bottling plants have continued to operate. So we took some of that and I shared it with our bottlers. At the same time, for example, Andina shared their protocols and some of the actions that they were taking. And I'm talking about, this is the first week of the crisis. So we were actually sharing what bottlers were doing, what the company was proposing, et cetera, but in a very open way. And I think that's the important thing, is to be very open, sharing, because we're all learning. No one has the right answer. It's just sharing and trying to learn from each other and learning from doing. And I think that has been encouraging for us because we see that there is a lot more communication going on now throughout the system.
Alfredo, in a consumer-centric environment, where a consumer-centric organization, where James keeps harping at more experimentation. I would think that there's also a lot less room for disagreements with bottlers, right? I mean, do you find yourself putting a lot of things to the test rather than just having debates without the consumer's input?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. And I think that we all recognize that we all bring points of views based on experiences, but it's best to experiment. And that's what we're trying to encourage, is instead of getting into dogmas or debates on who's right and who's wrong, is okay, let's understand what, you know, let's apply a scientific approach. Let's state a hypothesis, develop some guidelines, metrics, and then apply, and then go and do it and learn. And then when you learn, you can decide whether to refine it, or if it worked well, then how do we scale it? But that takes out a lot of the noise. One of the examples, what we did with Andina and Embonor in Chile, in the Oreca channel, you know, by bringing other products on board, there was a hypothesis and we tested it, came out well. I think we've had some learnings from that. And, you know, again, we're open to learning. As long as it's value accretive for the system, we're going to be in support of testing these. And of course, that's the obvious, that both bottlers and ourselves want to look for opportunities to create more value and grow our business.
Can we stay with that example, if you would please, just for a minute? So is the role of alcohol changing as you become more consumer-centric? Can you share with us a little bit more on what you learned, what insights you picked up in that Horeca experience in Chile, as bottlers have begun to sell and distribute spirits? Does it help you execute better at the point of sale? Do you own the day better because you now have something else to go into into those night accounts?
Right. I think that the idea and the commitment that we have is to look and develop. We believe that our success depends on developing solutions that are relevant for consumers and customers. In the specific case of Chile, what Andina identified, and Embonor, as we talked to them, and even our team locally, was that there was an opportunity to strengthen our position in the Oreca channel, because customers were telling us that they would like us to offer a broader portfolio. And that just made life easier for those customers. Now, what did we agree on? Well, one of the things was we wanted to see, will this have a positive impact on our core portfolio? So on Coca-Cola, our flavor brands, et cetera. How does that work? And we tested it. And it actually was a very interesting learning. By adding more feet in the street and focusing the sales force on a broader portfolio in that channel, we were able to grow our brands and grow revenue in that, and bring a relevant solution to customers. So again, this is we continue to learn and continue to adapt to this, and obviously making adjustments along the way. But again, we have to be disciplined in the approach of, is this a consumer relevant or a customer relevant solution, and how well can we execute it and learn, and obviously continuously refine it and improve on it. So as James said at the very beginning, you know, the concept of Beverages for Life is that we will look at all the opportunities out there that are relevant for consumers, but we'll also develop solutions for customers if we see that we can add value and strengthen our relationship with them. And I think that's an example there. But again, I want to stress that it has to be a disciplined approach.
It's a great example. Thank you. How might you rank some of the more promising consumer trends in Latin America that excite you? And where do food aggregators fit into that list? We were in Brazil, and some of the work that your team is doing in Brazil was just mind-blowing. Can you speak to the scope of this opportunity for our listeners, please?
Well, it's clear that the current situation has been an opportunity for e-commerce in the different ways that it appears. Consumers, which we know, consumers see e-commerce as a very relevant solution today, but they were actually already moving in that direction very quickly. So what we've been working, so that I think that's an exciting, and I'll talk more about digital and technology, and I saw your question, and I think there's a lot I want to tell you about that. The other piece that we have to be cognizant of, which I don't know if excited is the right word, but the reality is that Latin America is entering a period of slow to non-economic growth, and we need to adapt to that. So to your conversation with Gali on refillables, we need to understand how the consumer behavior is changing and making sure that our portfolio is relevant to them with the right brands, the right packaging, the right products. And obviously, we're entering a new world where we're going to have to be quick to learn, to experiment and learn to make sure that we are bringing relevant solutions for consumers and customers. On the food aggregating, back to the technology piece, we've actually learned a lot from our partnership with the food aggregators over the last few years. Obviously, e-commerce is not only food aggregators, there's other opportunities out there that we're exploring. But about 4 years ago, after a trip James took to China, he talked about how food aggregators were growing in China. And we actually went with James later, and then we took the CEOs of our bottlers, our largest bottlers in Latin America, to China. And we actually had the opportunity to meet and learn from Alibaba, from JD, from Tencent, a couple other companies, the technology companies, on how they were reaching consumers and how consumers were changing their behaviors based on the opportunities that technology brings. So one of the thoughts when we came back was, this, what we just saw in China, we thought will come to Latin America eventually, and I think we thought it was going to be a quite rapid movement. So we thought about, what does that mean for us? And one of the key things was, what does this mean for the traditional trade, for our mom and pops that represent a big, big part of our business, and more importantly, 3.5 million customers, traditional customers in Latin America that have an impact, there's an economic impact to their well-being and the communities they serve. And the idea was, how can we help them? So, and this actually generated a lot of work from the bottlers and from the company on experiments, on solutions that could be relevant. So not only from a B2B, but also B2C solutions that could help us get closer. And how could we partner with the food aggregators? So about 2 years ago, or actually a little bit more than 2 years ago, we actually acquired a small stake in Rappi, which is one of the largest food aggregators in Latin America. The idea was to partner with them and learn from them, and also learn how we could bring value to them. So we've had a very good relationship with them. We also have a very good relationship with iFoods in Brazil, as you saw. And the point is that we learned that we could work with the food aggregators to improve the incidence of our beverages and all the orders that were being that they were delivering, working also with our customers and then the aggregators. In the end, what we have is an organization in the business unit that works with our bottlers to create programs with the food aggregators to help them grow. And I think that we have a very good relationship across Latin America with food aggregators. I was looking at some data recently on Rappi, for example. Since the crisis came in, we're, in some cases in Brazil, our business has grown tenfold. In other parts, in Mexico, I think 3.5 times from a year ago. So there is rapid growth in the technology space. And obviously, we want to be part of that. And we are learning and partnering with as many partners as we can in order to learn.
As you think about how you can partner better with your clients, is the role of the red truck and the legacy limitations of what could go on that truck, is that likely to be changing faster as we go forward? And I ask because, as you say, whether it's a Mercado Libre or Amazon or Alibaba, this can really boost the bottler's business, and it can boost your sales considerably. And it opens up a whole reconsideration about direct home delivery and how you get to those to those consumers. Can you expand on that?
Yes, I think the opportunity is there. I don't think that there's an issue on using the red truck for distribution purposes. I mean, that seems pretty clear cut. I think that, again, on the experimentation side is are we talking about separate sales forces? How does that work in terms of products? What I think the opportunity is, though, and just to change a little bit the approach, is because our bottling system has the assets, has the trucks, has the capabilities, has the understanding, and more importantly, have built relationships with our customers, we're in a position to be able to serve those customers and bring solutions to them that they find highly relevant. And I think that that's an opportunity that we are beginning to explore. Some bottlers are developing B2B solutions. We have a solution called Wabi, which is it began as a business to consumer app that now has a B2B solution, and we're learning. So this is all a learning process, but we see that there is demand for that type of service or solution. Therefore, back to your question on the red truck, the red truck can help us or can help bring more solutions to the customers, and we're open to exploring that. Absolutely. Again, in a way that adds value to the customer, possibly to the consumer, and to the system. And of course, we'll be open to, and we are open to testing and learning.
So this all must be also part of the solution set that you're considering for Brazil, right? You look at 2022, and a lot of Heineken beer volume is going to be leaving those trucks. And so there's a lot of scale that comes off those trucks, and in terms of how you approach that trade. Can you speak to some of the ideas or solutions that can fill that gap and fill that void, and at the same time put you in a more competitively advantaged position vis-a-vis, some of the giants that are there?
Right. Well, I think, again, it's back to consumer and understanding what the consumer is looking for, and then then the customer. But what we did is we worked together with our bottling partners in Brazil and said, okay, with Heineken leaving, what are the alternatives we have? And then we developed a strategy. It's a three-pillar strategy. I think maybe Enrique Brown shared it with you in Brazil. But it's, look, there is a lot of opportunity in our sparkling business. We have a low mix of refillables. That's an opportunity that's very big. Stills is still small, relatively speaking. There's a big opportunity to develop the stills business. And by the way, very profitable, the core, the sparkling and the stills. And then there's a new frontier piece, which is, okay, what are those things that we can add that are relevant to customers or consumers? So back to the Chile example, in case there's some channels where we can serve a broader portfolio, or new beverages. So we're testing Schweppes Alcopop in Brazil, thinking that, is this an area where we can, is this an opportunity for us to explore further, which is an Alcopop solution. From learnings from other parts of the world, we think that there may be a role here, so we're exploring that. So we're trying to be as open as we can within, again, with discipline, so that we can explore and learn and drive the scale. But growth in Brazil is important, and growth at the core is what's going to drive the most value for the system in the future. But again, we're open and we're looking at different solutions to drive more scale into the system.
Alfredo, in Chile, we spend a lot of time this morning with Andina talking about the regulatory changes in Chile, mandating that modern trade, for example, carry refillable bottles, that they offer refillables as well as even the food aggregators. Can you speak to whether you're seeing regulatory pressures or regulatory moves happening in other countries as well. And this just seems to me that it's a huge market share growth opportunity for the Coca-Cola company. I mean, you've invested more in these refillables in Latin America than everybody else combined by a lot.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. Before the crisis, before COVID, one of the biggest challenges we were working on was on World Without Waste. And in Latin America in particular, refillables was a key part of our strategy to address that. So today and coming out of COVID, refillables for other reasons will even become more important for consumers. So if we connect both, which you mentioned earlier in a conversation with Galia, is connecting not only the affordability piece, but the sustainability piece, it gives us an opportunity to really expand into occasions, by the way, into occasions that normally wouldn't have thought of as relevant for refillables. We think that there will be an opportunity to expand, in, particularly in single-serve refillables, for occasions beyond on-premise. So we're working on that because we think that's going to be highly profitable for the system, and it will allow us to reinvent, if you will, our approach on occasions and how we use the packaging. So normally, when you think of Coke with meals, you're thinking of a large, you know, multi-serve pack for the family. Well, maybe single serve has a role there that we haven't explored, and this is an opportunity to do that. But regulation will continue to come around packaging, I think, when things normalize, and I think that we are in a good position. The other opportunity that we see is that in countries like Chile, where our mix of refillables is pretty high, they're actually the most profitable markets. So when you look at markets, and that's because they can combine the one-way packages, convenience and premium, plus, and then you have the refillables more affordable. But then you have all the capabilities that our bottlers have built around segmentation and RGM. Then you can actually create a lot more value. And I think that's a tremendous advantage for our system going forward is the capabilities that have been built over time.
Can you expand on that for a minute? Because that's a really important point that I think very often gets lost, that refillables help you premiumize. So often I hear as an analyst the question, well, isn't it a drag on returns for a bottler or on margins to focus on refillables? But I think what people sometimes miss is that if you can take refillable packages as affordable packages, it opens up your one ways for premiumization and to charge more to capture the value of that, the premiumness of your brands better in the one-way packages, and you can drive the pricing higher on the one-ways. And so you can open up your pricing architecture so much wider than if you didn't have those refillables. And so looking at refillables in a silo doesn't really capture the value of what it does for your premiumization. Are you seeing that at play here?
You're absolutely right, Carlos. And I think it took us a while to figure that out, by the way. So remember, when you looked at refillables, you say, oh, man, all the investment that's required, you know, by the bottles and all, you know. And I remember when it was out of fashion to be in refillables in Latin America. You know, I had to live through that process. And then we relearned that this was actually a game changer for us. By expanding our refillable base, by offering more options of refillable, then we freed up the one-ways. So when we do projects on refillables, we always look at, okay, what's the return on investment of this investment on bottles, for example, or on lines, et cetera. But then we have to factor in how that's going to free other packs so that we can move pricing up on one-ways. And that's when we look at it holistically, then we see the value it creates. And again, the evidence is there. We did some work. We put together an agile team with Coca-Cola FEMSA 3 years ago to precisely look at refillables. And actually, it was a universal bottle that we had already rolled it out in Chile or begun to roll it out. We wanted to see in a more holistic way, the impact of moving faster on the universal bottle. And it was fascinating to see the impact that by having a higher mix of refillables, your return on invested capital was much higher because you were able to premiumize your one ways. And I think that's, I'm saying something that now is common knowledge within our system and we're all working on that. But it was a big aha moment when we realized it.
Alfredo, digitalization, you've touched on this several times throughout our conversation, but how are you using it to your advantage in Latin America at the Coca-Cola company differently than 2 to 3 years ago? And how is this becoming an even bigger changing agent 3 years from now?
Okay. And I apologize because I think it'll be a long answer. So what we saw after I mentioned the trip to China, we started working on different initiatives as a system. Bottlers developing their own solutions. We developed our own solutions. But after, in 2018, in September, I remember we had a meeting with the three largest bottlers in our routinely, our CEO routine, CEO council routine. And we agreed on four areas that we would work on together as a system in Latin America. One of them was digital. The other were RGM, route to market, and sustainability. But on digital, one of the first things we did was to figure out what we were doing. So we took an inventory of all the programs that were out there, all the initiatives, digital initiatives. We had more than 90, and we were able to pare that down to 15. From my end, from the group level, we created a digital transformation office that coordinates efforts and lets bottlers, agrees with bottlers what initiatives are going to be pursued by each, and then we share. Okay. So we looked at, for example, a Coca-Cola company directly. We have been focusing a lot on food aggregators, and then on a solution called Wabi, which began in Buenos Aires, which is a B2C solution. It's basically a WhatsApp, not a WhatsApp solution. It's like an Uber solution where consumers download an app and they will order products, and those products will come from the nearest mom and pop. So this has actually expanded very rapidly. We're now in 12 cities in Latin America. We're still trying to scale it up, but the solution is interesting because it gives a new revenue stream to our mom and pops. As we continue to grow, we think that this will be an important proximity solution for consumers. And because of the crisis, we've seen results actually where we're growing at 200%. And this is not this solution allows consumers not only to buy our beverages, but to buy the normal groceries that they would buy at a mom and pop, including competing products. Because what we decided is that this is a solution for the consumer and for the customer. Therefore, we need to be open and let people use a platform for whatever their needs are. And we're obviously getting the data, which allows us to get to know our consumers and customers better and provide better solutions to them. So the data analytics angle is a very, very relevant for us going forward. We've made a commitment in a broader way now where we're working on creating a consumer database of 100 million consumers in 3 years. So we're very focused on that. That's a lot of work. And we're working closely with our bottlers in order to create one data lake that allows us to access information and be able to apply data analytics. So in a broad sense, the key thing for us was to come together and work together on the solutions that we felt were more relevant as a system so that then we can help each other out and then come up with whatever solution works best, then we can agree to scale it.
Alfredo, what might be missing? And this is my final question to you. What might be missing in terms of your effort to bring more value add to the table to your bottling partners so that you can continue to motivate these families to make extraordinary investments behind the brands?
Well, I think that's a good question. Well, what I think we are committed to doing is to continue to work hand in hand like we've been doing for almost 100 years in Latin America, actually more than 100 years in Latin America, working with our bottling partners together, investing with them, and working in a way which can be more open. One of the big concerns of our bottling partners is, are the returns the ones that I want? And usually what happens, and it happens to us also, is what I've learned over the years is when we work together to adapt to the changing environment, and I think that today is a perfect example of a changing environment where we don't have clarity what the future holds, we have an opportunity then to create our future, to really shape our business going forward, to change those things that we, those structural changes that we may have not done before. This is the opportunity to move forward and do that. And I think that what we bring as partners to our bottling system is that we bring a strong point of view. We bring our experience and an open mind so that we can arrive at any, so that we can work with their point of view, our point of view, and come out with a stronger point of view on what we need to do. Because the business in Latin America in particular, it's clearly been very successful because we've been able to work together and in the end, agree on the right path forward. So the challenge for us going forward is to continue stressing the fact that we're stronger when we're together. Or as that saying is, two minds are better than one, right? Two heads are better than one. But that's where I think the value is in our system that's unique, is the ability to work together to look for solutions and to adapt to a changing environment. I think that what we're facing today is a tremendous opportunity for the system, for our bottling partners, for the Coca-Cola company, to sit down and say, okay, how do we shape that future together that's going to provide us with the sustainable returns that we all want? And I think this is a moment for us to work together in that direction.
Thank you. Maybe we can close out the last two questions with for Tim. We had some questions coming in here from investors, Tim. The first one was, how likely is the company to accelerate the refranchising of company-owned bottling assets?
On that one, Carlos, I would not say that there's any real change in the approach that we've talked about. I mean, obviously it comes down to South Africa, India, and our Southeast bottler ownerships. And at this stage, we've been pretty clear that, particularly with South Africa and the Philippines, that it would be a bit of time before we move to a refranchising. I don't think that's changed, and if anything, it's probably potentially delayed it just a little bit in the context of obviously recognizing that our number one priority against all of this is to make sure that those operations are managing through what we're all dealing with. This is a particularly complicated time and challenging time. So within that, then I don't think we're in a scenario where we would be looking to try to accelerate that. And certainly I think no matter what, it would be a challenge, particularly in the near term, to find the right buyer, the right price, et cetera, to deal with all of that. So, but the only thing I would reiterate is what James and John said in February before this really the virus kicked in is that our longer-term strategy of trying to be the smallest possible bottler that we can be is still very much intact. It's just the timing of it is going to be the key question mark there.
And the final question, Tim, is as you hear James speak internally to his team, 2 years from now, what do you think is going to be the biggest change that will have happened at the Coca-Cola company and maybe even for the industry?
That's a great question. You know, from my perspective, I can't I keep coming back to the cultural shift that has been underway and has accelerated, beyond question. even Brian Smith in an internal meeting a week or two ago said, you know, look, what we are trying to accomplish from a cultural shift, you know, over the next 12 to 18 months is happening almost overnight. And, you know, a lot of it obviously is clearly by necessity, but that's one of the positives. If there are some that are coming out of this, that's a clear positive. And I think for us as a company, in 2 years, that's for me going to be one of the biggest benefits I see coming out of it. I think the other reality from an overall industry perspective is that there is going to be a forcing mechanism on really forcing companies to think about brands. Gaia mentioned brands, you know, brand edge. I think in an environment where there's limited resources at a company level, there's limited resources at a consumer level, the brands that can bring value both economically from an importance, relevance to their lives, I think are going to be incredibly important, are going to be the ones that ultimately win. And that's why, in all of the things that we talked about today that we're doing in Latin America, and I think you could say very similar things in other parts of the world for sure, I think are going to allow us to be in that position where we have a higher proportion of that share of brands that matter in consumers and customers' lives. And you know, within that, you know, I'm glad that I'm part of this team that's focused on that. Glad I'm part of the group that's helping to drive some of the transformation and the cultural shifts that are taking place, not just even within the company, but from a system perspective, as Gaia and Alfredo both talked about on numerous occasions already, that it's meaningful, and it's not just lip service. You know, we can see it in the day-to-day conversations and discussions that are taking place. And I'm sure, as you even noted at the beginning, is, you know, bottlers are not shy to express their points of view when they see things that need to change within the system. And certainly, I think the commentary and the feedback you've been getting is reflective that those changes are taking place.
Well, it is, Tim. Thank you. And look, as an outsider, golly, Alfredo, Tim, I mean, the amount of change that you're driving is so impressive, and it's notable. I've never seen so much change in 30 years of looking at the Coca-Cola Company like we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years. And so congratulations, and thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. You gave us an awful lot to chew on and think about for the next few days. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Carlos.
You.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate y'all joining. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thanks.